Left Field Investors is a community dedicated to limited partner investors who are interested in building wealth through real estate investing. The community is focused on education, networking, and engagement with quality operators and partners. We provide tools, webinars, and a forum where members can discuss everything related to real estate investing, including deals, operators, investment strategies, and much more. Coming soon, we're adding a new tool, sponsor reviews. This will be a place where our members can rate and review operating partners to further help each other in our investment journeys. Check us out at leftfieldinvestors.com.
You know, you think that if the Fed's reducing rates that the 10-year treasury is going to go down, but that's not necessarily the case. So this is financial engineering that is probably more complicated.
Hello, left fielders. Welcome to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast. Our community is focused on networking and education to help people invest passively and think differently. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Dave Zook from The Real Asset Investor, and you're listening to Passive Investing from Left Field.
I'm really excited today to have John Chang with us. He serves as the National Director of Research Services for Marcus & Millichap. He's responsible for the production of the firm's vast array of commercial real estate research publications, tools, and services. Under his leadership, Marcus & Millichap has become a leading source of market analysis, insight, and forecasting, and the firm's research is regularly quoted throughout the industry and in mainstream business media, and we're really pleased to have you here. John, welcome to the Passive Investing from Left Field podcast.
Thanks, Jim.
As I said, really honored that you're here. You know, we want to dig in and get as much information out of you as we can. But the way we like to start is if you can kind of just tell us your journey. How did you get interested in real estate? How did you find Marcus Millichap? And how did you become kind of the research guy?
Sure. You know, my journey in real estate actually started when I was 4 years old, ironically. I remember going with my dad to look at his first rental property that he bought. And I was just a little guy and wandering through this house thinking, man, this place needs a lot of work. And so we went through, my dad ultimately bought that house and many others and remodeled them and rented them. He still owns many of them today. I joined Marcus & Millichap in 1997 to run research for the Seattle Metro. And I worked with the company and kind of grew my career here for a few years. I went on to work in other real estate companies for the next 7 years and came back to Marcus & Millichap in 07 to run the research department. And I've been here ever since. So it's really been very intriguing for me. I've always been somebody who's looking at how the pieces of the puzzle fit together. And in real estate, that has a tremendous amount of value. And culturally within Marcus & Millichap, that's part of who we are. So it was a really good fit for me.
That's excellent. Well, thank you for that. And I just want to jump in here. You know, this is a very broad question, so we can dig down in it a little bit. But what's the general outlook for the real estate market in 2024, including kind of what asset classes do you think are poised to do well and what could struggle?
Yeah, 2024 is going to be a interesting year. I'll characterize it that way. I think there's a lot of opportunity. I don't think that anybody's going to sit back and say, man, you know, this property type blew the doors off in 2024. I think it's a reset year. I think it's a staging year. And for investors who are thinking longer term, I think there's a lot of opportunity out there. It's going to definitely be what I characterize as a roll up the sleeves kind of year. And that means it's a lot of value add, whether you're adding value through repairs and maintenance and upgrades, or if you're adding value through management and skills and knowledge you have or relationships, depending on the property type, you know, it may be because you have great leasing relationships, or you may have, you know, just really good ties into the industry that enable you to lift an asset up. I think that there's a lot of inventory that will come onto the market. I don't think there will be a lot of distress per se, but I do think that there are investors who will be motivated to sell in 2024. And for the right investors, those who have the skills to create value with the real estate, I think that there's going to be some really solid opportunities that pay dividends over the next 5 to 10 years, which is the typical hold period for commercial real estate.
And how do LPs, limited partner investors, you know, that's the passive investing group that Left Field Investors has. How do we take advantage of this, you know, opportunity with some of those that are really adding value and doing the right things to save already, you know, properties they've already purchased or enhance those as opposed to the other ones that might be struggling? What do you think LP investors can do to kind of make sure they're in the right spot at the right time, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it can be tough for LP investors, but you do have some advantages built in. So what I'd be careful of over the last 5 years, 10 years, real estate has been doing very, very well. The tide has been lifting all boats. And what you really have to do is really understand who is the GP, who's the general partner, who's running that operation, and what does their team look like? You know, it's not something where you can just, you know, pick one that has, say, the, you know, highest returns or the highest historical returns. I would be looking at the leadership team and really understand what they bring to the table, their relationships, their skills, their knowledge, because I think that there will be a lot of syndicators and investors who do very well, but those are going to be the ones with the deep knowledge base. They also have to have a strong financial foundation so they don't get put at risk. But I look at how they financed properties in the past, whether they got in trouble from the adjustable rate mortgages that they came through, and whether they were prepared for that. And so those investors that are thinking longer term, who understand the nuances and the ups and downs in the markets and the risks that they're taking, are going to be in a better position. So really, as a passive investor, I'm looking at the leadership team and the management of the firm, and then looking at the assets that they're focused on, and then going in and participating in deals that way.
Can you dig in a little bit deeper into what we should be looking for in the leadership team? Because some of us, you know, we've had discussions in our community where, you know, we found operators that had great experience going back, you know, years and years through difficult times. They had a track record of 30% plus returns. And they seem to have all the boxes checked, referred to people, referred to us by people with no like and trust. And then this adjustable, you know, the mortgage interest rates went high and they got in trouble with their adjustable rate loans. But what that revealed was operational issues. It wasn't just conveniently they can blame it on adjustable rate loans, but they hadn't been completing the business plan. So part of what we're struggling in our community to figure out is how do we sniff that out ahead of time? Because we thought we were checking all the right boxes, you know, talking about the leadership team and all of those things that you mentioned, but we still kind of ended up in a tough spot. And so now we're kind of reeling, like we feel like we did it all right, but we still had some poor results in certain situations. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And you know, it's the old Warren Buffett quote, right? When the tide goes out, you can see who's swimming naked. And so really, this is the opportunity. Actually, now you can see who got caught, who was caught by the adjustable rates. Now, a lot of really good operators did get caught by that. They may have had shorter term coverage and protection against that, and they just didn't have enough on there to last. They had the right ideas, and they were positioned well to maximize returns, and they did get caught. So I wouldn't just throw everybody out who got caught by the adjustable rate mortgages, because that caught, you know, a big portion of the industry. But when you look at the performance and you dig under the surface of how this affected them in this cycle, you can really see what the ones who are playing with more risk, they may have learned from this as well. So they may have gone, gee, you know what, we really weren't dialed in on this piece, and here's how we're changing our operations. But the thing is, we haven't had a significant setback in the real estate industry. I mean, we had the pandemic, and that created some challenges, but there was a lot of stimulus going on at the same time that helped the industry. But you have to go all the way back to the financial crisis in 08, 09, and 10 to really see who's had, you know, who's been tested by the market, per se. And so it's hard to find that track record. And that's what this opportunity creates, is an opportunity to see who did well, who did poorly. I met with an investor a few weeks ago at the National Multi-Housing Council Conference, the NMHC conference. They have one of the largest portfolios of apartments in the country. They basically are an equity fund, and they do these with passive investors. And they always use fixed rate financing, period, for their entire history. They've only used fixed rate finance. Now, that has strengths and weaknesses. Right now, they're saying, hey, we didn't get caught. We're perfectly fine. We did great through this downturn, and we have lots of capital. We're ready to roll. But again, they left margin on the table when things were going great and interest rates, you know, were falling. So, you know, there's pros and cons, but they have that durability and stability out there. Again, there are a lot of investors who are well positioned. There are a lot of investors who really understand the market. And, you know, again, this downturn was particularly complex in that it was really driven by the rising interest rates and how it changed the math and the equation on the yields. So that is an opportunity. That's an opportunity, especially again for the passive investors, to ferret out who outperformed, who was ready, who had their operations dialed in. And, you know, quite literally a few years ago, you never would have known. You couldn't tell. There were no indicators out there. And now you have that information available.
That's a great point. I love that. And then I want to dig in a little bit also, and maybe not just for 2024, but over the next few years, are there asset classes that you think will outperform other ones? Is it multifamily? Is it self-storage? I mean, there's a ton of asset classes out there. Where are you looking mostly?
Wow. Because I track 10 different property types on any given day, right? We're, you know, my team, our research team is focused on providing insight on 10 different property types. And so as I look at each of them, I see opportunity, but I'm a cup half full kind of person. Let me just kind of give you a gamut here, and I'll just kind of run through a laundry list and just tell you what I like and what some of the risks are. Starting with multifamily, right? Multifamily, we have 480,000 new units coming online in 2024. That is going to be a setback, even though we believe absorption is rising this year. I see consumer sentiment, which is a leading indicator, pointing towards growth. But we still have this wave of development that is huge. This is the most we've delivered since the 80s. So that is the challenge. But the positive is the demographics are pointed the right direction, and the affordability of single family homes is terrible. So a lot more people are going to stay in apartments for a lot longer. I believe that we still have something around 3 million housing unit shortage that will continue to be opportunities for apartment investors as we go forward. Self-storage has done very well. It's been countercyclical, but I do believe that there is a wave of construction on the horizon for self-storage that I would be cautious of. That doesn't mean it won't do well, but that means that any investor who's out there in self-storage needs to have a really good handle on what the pipeline of construction will be over the next 3 years or so. You look at retail. Retail has done really well. This is a segment of the market that was just crushed 10 years ago. We were hearing in the media retail apocalypse for years, and there were challenges. They were getting beat up by e-commerce, but that market has stabilized. There's been almost no new construction since 07, really, to speak of. And so you have the fundamentals coming back into alignment. When I talk to actually the research people in the retail companies, companies like Target and so on, they're saying, hey, we can't find good locations. That's our biggest challenge. We're having to build out locations because we can't find enough existing space. And retail is positioned to do very well over the next few years because there's simply a shortage of space. Consumption is up, and businesses in the retail have adapted to the new e-commerce world. So I like retail a lot. Industrial, like apartments, has this huge wave of construction that is going to impact the sector over the short term. There's the vast majority, over 50% of the inventory is concentrated in 8 markets, I think. So you kind of have to really understand on a market by market basis what's happening with industrial. infill industrial, I love it. But the larger big bay industrial, there are markets where there's going to be challenges. But over the long term, that space is going to be needed. And there are some longer term trends affecting industrial that put some markets in better positions than others. When I look at office, it's challenging. I personally believe that over the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see demand for office revive. It will be concentrated, in my opinion, in suburban areas, and it will be newer properties. When you look at where the concentration of vacancies are for office, it's older, larger, as in 250,000 and larger square footage office towers in the urban core. And that's tied to demographics, that's tied to migration, that's tied to the pandemic and the people's movement out of the urban core. So I think the suburban office is going to outperform. I think there's opportunities there. It's very difficult to get office financed right now still. And I think that there's going to be some challenges acquiring those properties unless you're very well financed. But I think that there are some real opportunities there. But it's going to be a long-term play, and it's a little bit riskier. It's a little bit more opportunistic, and it will test it. Medical office is another property type that's doing, I think it's fantastic. You can tie into 15-year or 12-year leases. I think it generates around an 8% yield, 7 to 8% yield. And I was speaking at a medical office conference, and they're so trying to get so far away from office as they can. They're calling them medical outpatient buildings now in order to get the word office out of there so they can get the financing for those properties. Seniors housing is another one that has great long-term demand drivers. That's demographics driven. You see the population turning 75 and older, increasing very rapidly. 75 years is the tipping point. But again, seniors housing is a very complicated property type, and anybody who's operating in it really needs to know what they're doing. And it is going to be going through changes over the next few years. And then finally, hospitality just really took a beating during the pandemic. It has fully recovered in terms of the rates on the hotel rooms. Occupancy levels are still a little bit down, but that's in part because they have a labor shortage and they're not releasing all of their hotel units for rent because they just don't have the appropriate staff. So I think hospitality, hotels, again, they've been outperforming, and I think the outlook for them looks good still, barring a significant recession, which we're not anticipating at this point. So there you go. There's the whole spread.
That is awesome. I know that myself and many of our listeners are going to be hitting the back button on that to listen to it a couple of times. So that was phenomenal. Thank you very much for that. Now, I want to dive into, I've been reading a little bit of some of the things that you've said, that loan delinquency rates, you know, for most asset classes are in line with historical norms. That surprised me, and low compared to past turbulent or difficult times. So the question is, you know, what does that mean for investors? I guess there might not be defaults, but are lenders working with the operators to instead of, you know, take the property back to work with them, or operators selling at a loss and blowing out the equity just to avoid foreclosure and issues with the banks? If you could just talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I think, Jim, you nailed it there, because it's all of the above, right? Some of them some of them are deferring their debt. Now, the banking system actually the FDIC in June of last year came out with guidance for banks saying, hey, if you want to work with your borrowers at your discretion, you can extend these loans. You can do some sort of workout. You can do some sort of, partnership with your client to extend these out and defer it. So a lot of that was done. In fact, we just got some new data from the Mortgage Bankers Association literally just the other day. And we got new numbers on the banking loan maturities, the mortgage loan maturities on commercial real estate. And we saw a huge jump in the amount of debt coming due in 2024. Now, nobody was out there in 2023 buying properties and getting a one-year loan on them. That's not what they were trying to do. Most of that is a deferral. So we're estimating that of the about $730 billion of debt coming due in 2023. Somewhere between 300 to 500 billion of that was actually deferred. Nobody's tracking the exact number, you know, so let's just call it in the middle. We'll say, you know, 400 billion was deferred into the future. Now, as an investor, when you're looking at this property, say it's an apartment property, you got caught short, you had to work something out with the bank, you didn't want to refinance your 3% loan at you know, 8% or 7%, and so you worked out a deal with them and you push it back. Why? Because as an apartment property in most markets, you know that the fundamentals are going to be strengthening over the next few years because the demographics are favorable and so on. If you own an office in San Francisco, downtown San Francisco, and it's largely vacant, and you look at it and say, man, I don't see a pathway to getting this thing filled back up and cash flow positive. In that case, you may be in a short sell situation. I was talking to an investor, a major institution. They owned an office building in San Francisco. It was on their books for $120 million. They sold it for $45 million, and they were so happy to get it off their books because they didn't have a pathway to turn that property around. So they want to take that capital and roll it into something where they can make money for their investors and just let bygones be bygones. It's a sunk cost for them. Now, at the same time, there are going to be some who know how to turn that around and some that don't. And the ones who can't get that turnaround and they can't sell it, they owe too much or whatever it is, they may just go back and hand the keys to the bank. And we saw some of those events take place over the last year or so. I think we're on the backside of that. I don't think we're going to see, you know, most of that's been flushed out of the market already. But I do think that there are, that's the question, right? The question is, do I have a pathway to get this property turned around? If so, I'm going to try to figure out how to salvage my situation. If I don't, or if I'm at a loss, I simply don't have the capital. I don't want to use the rescue capital that's out there because it charges whatever, 10%. I may let it go. I may short sell it. I may work a deal with the bank where I can liquidate it. I know there are syndicators and other investors out there who did capital calls. And there are those that really just said, we're going to try to sell it for the value of the loan. And everybody takes a bath on this one. It did happen. It is happening. It's not the majority, but there is some of it out there. So that's, again, you can tell the investors who were prepared for this event and had planned ahead and had safety systems in place and those that didn't.
Rustmill Capital is an elite Ohio-based private equity firm with a specialization in long-term, high cash flow multifamily investments. If you're looking for long-term recurring income, you should check out Rustmill Capital. From their approach to managing risk to the locations they invest, the product quality they provide, this firm is serious about what they do, which is why the owners of Rust Belt Capital invest their money in every deal they take on. Review their case studies by visiting rustbeltcapital.com. That's rustbeltcapital.com. Once again, rustbeltcapital.com or email investor@rustbeltcapital.com.
This episode is sponsored by Midlock Investment Partners, the real estate investment firm, operator, and fund manager. Midlock invests in middle market properties valued between $5 and $50 million in the Midwest and beyond using a value add strategy. Learn more about Midlock and join their mailing list at midlock.com. That's Midlock, MIDLOCH.com. Thanks, Midlock, for being a sponsor of Passive Investing from Left Field. How do rate caps on adjustable rate mortgages factor into this? Because what we're seeing with some of our syndicators is they have to pay so much for those rate caps. And as I understand it, it's not the interest rate that determines it. It's the volatility in the interest rate that determines the cost of the rate cap. So they just can't get ahead of it because the rate cap cost keeps going up. And that's what's really causing the problem with a little bit of insurance cost inflation in there as well. So can you talk about the rate caps and the effect that's having on these loan workouts? Because the banks might be working out some loans, but it doesn't seem like they're flexible with the cost of the rate caps or the escrow of those rate caps.
Yeah, the rate caps are a whole different. It is more like an insurance product, right? So it's built on financial models. So the bank may be working something out with the borrower, extension of existing loan terms or something like that. But those rate caps are a whole different ballgame. Now, here's the big question. And again, when I'm talking to investors, this is an ongoing conversation with the most active investors is, have the rates already peaked out? Do I really need a rate cap? And again, that's playing with that risk again. But right now, the consensus is that rates are going to be going down over the next year. At least the Federal Reserve has indicated they're going to start reducing rates. Now, that doesn't mean the 10-year treasury upon which most rents, most mortgages are written, or the adjustable rate mortgages off of the LIBOR or something like that are going to be, reliably going down. But I do believe that as the Federal Reserve cuts rates over the course of 2024, and our model currently suggests that we may have 3 or 4 rate cuts. We may drop, the Federal Reserve may drop rates by 75 basis points, 100 basis points, somewhere in there over the span of the year. Most of that's going to be in the second half, if not all of it. The first rate cut may be in May or June. I personally believe they're going to have a very slow roll process, maybe do a rate cut every 2 months as long as the numbers keep moving in the right direction. But if we get a couple of rate cuts from the Fed, the mortgage rates should start to come down. And the reason is that the banks built their safety spread. Normally, they have a 150 to 200 basis point spread over the underlying rate, say the 10-year treasury. Right now, and for the last 18 months or so, they widened that to a 300 basis point spread in order to increase their margin and their safety, their risk on that, to reduce their risk on those loans. So as the underlying rates start to come down, as the Fed cuts rates, the banks may start to shrink that margin. And as they do, those rates may come down. But those rate caps and that insurance policy, yes, they're very expensive. And, that's one of those places where as an investor, you have to sit down and run the math and say, okay, how do we prepare if rates go up? You know, if we use adjustable rates right now, and rates go up, how do we address it? Do we want that cap? Do we want it for 3 years, 2 years, 1 year? What kind of a time frame do we want it for? Do we lock in long-term financing instead? Do we go with a 5-year fix or something like that? That's really an ongoing conversation. I see investors going every direction on that right now.
And could we have some positive surprises on the rate cap issue? Meaning, let's say they do lower interest rates by 75 basis points or 100, and will that then cause the money that people are putting into escrow right now for those rate caps to be released because perhaps the rate cap prices go down? Is that making sense? So perhaps then they'll be able to release money.
It's possible. But, those kind of financial predictions are really hard to make, right?
Yeah.
Because, it depends on what you're basing it on, like the SOFR or the 10-year treasury. I have to say, the 10-year treasury and the SOFR are very hard to predict. It works counterintuitively sometimes. You think that if the Fed's reducing rates, that the 10-year treasury is going to go down, but that's not necessarily the case. So this is financial engineering that is probably more complicated. I would want somebody who really understands the financial markets to make recommendations on that side.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you've talked about construction costs, right? They're up significantly compared to before the pandemic. And we touched on this a little bit, but there's 67 million square feet of office coming online in 2024 into a market that already has high vacancy, while multifamily and industrial are both delivering near record new units. So how will all of this affect these markets, especially given that the new units likely cost much more to build than previously? So what will this do to the value add investments that are coming online as well? I know that's a lot of questions in there, but I'm just kind of curious how all this might affect these markets.
There's a lot baked in there. So there are a lot of different property types. Let me address office really quickly, where we see that construction. We're seeing, a fair amount in Boston, Dallas, Austin, some in Seattle, some in San Diego. But I want to point out there are a few markets, just a handful, but there are a handful of markets that actually have a lower vacancy rate today than they did in 2019. That includes West Palm Beach in Florida. That includes Las Vegas. I think the Inland Empire is about a break even in Riverside, San Bernardino in California. So not all office markets are in big trouble. Other markets like Dallas, for example, the urban core has a high vacancy rate, but when you look at the suburban areas, their vacancy rates tend to be much lower. Austin has huge growth. I think they may be a little bit overreaching, getting out in front of their skis a little bit on their development there. But that is going to be not necessarily going to be the impact on the market that you may think. And again, there's a lot of specialty office going in, some medical office, some biotech office, for example, in San Diego, that has a pretty strong outlook as well. So it's easy to generalize, but it's not always the development itself is not necessarily a bad thing. Going into apartments, yes, absolutely. Some markets got hit really hard. I'm based in Phoenix, Arizona. We have this huge wave of new completions here. And you're seeing that also in markets like Dallas and Austin and other Sunbelt metros. And the result of that is that vacancies have risen. We're seeing concessions from the new properties as they enter lease up. They're cannibalizing your Class A renters in the 2-year-old buildings, and it works its way down the food chain. Everybody's dropping their rents or offering concessions, and they're cannibalizing the next tier down renter. And that domino effect is going to roll through the marketplace over the course of 2024 and perhaps even into 2025. But on the backside of that, these are also some of the strongest growth markets, Phoenix, Dallas. You're seeing tremendous job creation. You're seeing inbound population migration, and those housing needs are there. So it's really a complex year in terms of our forecasting, in terms of how much gets delivered versus how much demand is going to come into the marketplace and where that's going to go ultimately. But I do believe after 2024, the wave of construction, we're going to be on the backside. We're going to see a significant drop off in construction activity. The number of new starts has come down dramatically. The cost of capital for construction is running between 8% and 10%. It's very difficult to build at that rate. The cost of lumber and steel and raw materials, labor costs associated with construction has gone up dramatically, and those numbers are much more difficult to pencil. So what that means is that wave of construction is going to be reduced over the next few years, and that will give time for these markets to absorb those units. So when I'm looking at a market like a Phoenix or a Dallas, I'm looking at it and saying, okay, how long until we absorb this overhang? And how long until we really see the momentum recover? And I do firmly believe that these are markets that have some of the strongest employment growth historically. And I see the pipeline for opportunity going forward. And it's really a question of, okay, how long until we get there? And what happens to pricing on these properties in between? Because as an investor, again, you're looking 3, 5, 7, 10 years out on these investments. And you say, yeah, it has some turbulence. It has some challenges today. But where is it going to be in year 5? Where is it going to be 5 years from now? That's what I want to know. Because if I can predict that, then I can figure out the exit returns. And those exit returns are ultimately where the big payday is. So looking for those properties, looking for those markets that face challenges today, but actually are going to play through and come out the other side, those are your opportunistic investments.
Okay, I want to switch a little bit and talk about interest rates. I know we touched on it here and there, but and I don't know what normal is, but when do interest rates get back to normal? I know that, you know, interest rates were super high in the 80s and people still seem to make money in the 80s, right? So I guess, do we need them to get back to normal, or are we just looking for some stability? Can you talk generally about where you see interest rates going and what investors need to see before they can be confident that things are back on track?
See, I love that question because normal is different for different people, right? So when I talk to younger people, and by younger, I mean people who've been in the business for 15 years or less, and you know, really came into the industry after the financial crisis. Normal interest rates to them are 2-4% for the 10-year treasury. If you talk to an investor who survived the financial crisis, but not only that, but had been doing business for 20 years or 25 years, normal for them is where we are today, 4% for the 10-year treasury. And if you go back even farther, the old timers who've been in the business going back into the 90s and even the 80s, normal for them was even higher. It was a 5% average, 6% average for them. So the term normal, right, and the expectations of what interest rates will do, there's generation gaps. And that generation gap is really significant because for an investor who's been in the business for a very long time, going back into, say, the 90s or the early 2000s, they understand the dynamics of this market. They know where the cap rates have to be, where the assets have to be, and how to create value. Historically, real estate was all about creating value. It was all about value add. Finding the right property in the right location, finding different ways to improve that property, make it better, and generate and create value. That's what that investor is looking for. And those are the guys who are gals who are going to be able to really look at this and say, okay, I know this game. That was when I was, you know, in my 20s or whatever. And when I was, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they know that this is a different ballgame. If you switch over to the post-financial crisis model, values were beaten down, interest rates were very low, and there was a lot of opportunity to pick up assets in 2012, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, and then in 2021, where you could get really low interest rates. And through most of that time period, the cap rates were falling for most property types. So you had a lot of tailwinds during that cycle. And those investors are used to having the wind at their back. I call them the children of summer, right? They've only had good times and they don't realize how good it's been, or quote unquote, how easy it's been relative to prior cycles. And so those investors are saying, well, when are they going to get back to normal? And by that, they mean, when is the 10-year treasury going to go back down to 3%? And when can I get financing at whatever, 4, 5, 6%? Five would probably be the target for that group. And we may not get back there. Based on the positioning from Chairman Powell, and you got to remember, all the way, ever since the financial crisis, the Federal Reserve has said, we want to raise those overnight rates. We want to raise rates. They're too low. But because there was no inflation, they didn't have a real reason to. They didn't want to just go out and do it willy-nilly. So until we had that wave of inflation, they didn't have a reason to raise rates. But they're going to want to keep that powder dry. They want that in reserve. They're not going to reduce them significantly. It's not going to go back down to a, you know, an overnight rate of a quarter point or a half a point. We're just not going back into that cycle unless there is a real recession. A serious recession. At that point, they're going to start dropping those rates again. But barring that, I don't see that movement coming back down. And normal rates, literally, I would say plus or minus 50 basis points off of 4% is probably where we're going to be looking over the next. That's for the 10-year treasury. Over the next couple years is probably. You know, again, assuming we don't have a major economic setback or something like that.
Okay, great. And speaking of, you know, I don't want to talk about economic setbacks, but is there an undervalued or overlooked factor that might either help or hurt the real estate industry in 2004 and surprise people or in the near future? I mean, people might have expected interest rates to rise, but I don't think anyone expected them to rise at the pace that they did. So is there something else that we should be looking out for and protecting ourselves as investors to make sure that we see it coming?
So I had an event with Mark Zandi, the chief economist from Moody's, about a month ago. And, you know, he's saying, hey, I believe we're going to have a soft landing. In fact, I'm really convinced of that. I give it a 60% probability, right? So, wait, hey, I thought you were really convinced. And he's like, well, you know, there's 25% chance we go into a recession. There's 15% chance that inflation bounces back up and we have what they call a no landing, right? Where inflation goes back up and the employment market stays strong. And basically we're in an overheated climate. And so you don't know. That's a 25% chance that something goes wrong. Right. And I'd be prepared for that. It's difficult to prepare for that. But as you look at an individual asset, if you're trying to evaluate, oh, should I put money into this? How recession resistant is this property type? How recession resistant is this asset? Because although everybody believes we're going into, not everybody, but most people believe we're going into a soft landing scenario and we're going to see interest rates dropping a little bit at a time, you do want to look at the demand drivers for a property, for an asset. You want to look at the recession risk, and you want to watch out for those, you know, I hate to use the term, but a black swan that, you know, that knocks the wheels off the cart, because you always need to prepare for that, even in the best of times. And certainly right now, that's what I'm looking at. I can't think of a specific event that I think is particularly risky. I mean, we got Houthi rebels firing missiles at cargo ships over by the Suez Canal, which is going to drive up shipping costs and create inflationary pressure. If they cause enough damage and insurance rates on cargo ships go through the roof, then we could have a real problem with shipping and supply chains. I mean, that's just one of those random things that I'm monitoring where you don't know exactly how that's going to go or what its effect will be, but it could really affect supply chains. So there's little things, and I say little because it's not a huge macro trend, but there are issues that are always out there that could throw a curveball at us.
Well, this has been fantastic information. Now, I know that you know, Left Field Investors, we're going to the Best Ever Conference, and we're having a day that is designed just for limited partner education. Now, I understand you are also going to be at the Best Ever Conference. So can you tell us when you're going to be there and what you're going to be doing?
I am going to actually be there all week. On the first day, I'm doing a special workshop, a 3-hour workshop on how to use information to build investment strategies. And I'm going to walk through a lot of the tools that I use and a lot of the ways I think about different types of analysis to evaluate individual assets, markets, and opportunities. So anybody who can be there, I think that's on Tuesday. That's a 3-hour workshop, which I normally don't do with something that long, but I love the Best Ever Conference and the people who are there. So I'll be doing that. I'm also going to participate in the big debate. I've done that for the last few years and I usually win. So I always have a great time with the debate. They're so much fun. They're a little tongue in cheek and I always try to throw in a zombie apocalypse as one scenario in that. But I will also be doing the closing session on Friday morning. And so just before they announce the winner of the big contest they have, I'll be doing that speaking engagement from the main stage on Friday morning. So it's a busy week for me. I'll be there all week. I love to talk with investors and GPs and LPs and talk about real estate. It's the one event per year where I get to go around and talk to everybody about a subject I love.
That's awesome. Yeah, we're super excited today about this too, because on that Tuesday, we will be doing the full day of a deep dive into LP investor education. So it seems like we're on similar paths there. We're super excited about it. The last question I always ask is, what's a great podcast that you listen to? It can be real estate or it can be something fun, yeah, other than real estate.
Yeah, you know, I actually don't listen to a lot of podcasts, but there is one that I actually listen to, which I enjoy a lot, and that's called Pickleball Studio. And so not your mainstream real estate thing, but I love that podcast because what they do is they do a lot of analytics on pickleball. So they're tracking and measuring stuff, which just naturally relates to me. And so they're tracking and measuring the spin ratios of paddles and other things like that. And I find it very interesting, and they're fun guys to listen to.
That's great. We'll put that in the show notes. And then lastly, if listeners want to follow you, what's the best way they can do that?
Probably the best way is to follow me on LinkedIn. I post all my videos every week. I shoot a economic and commercial real estate video. We post those there. We also announce all of our major research releases. We just came out with our 2024 investment forecast for multifamily, for retail, for office, for self-storage, for hospitality, and industrial is in production this week. So these are full-on 50 market analytical booklets. You can download them off our website, but we announce any new research release on LinkedIn under my name, John T. Chang, if anybody wants to follow me there.
Excellent. Thank you. I'll put that in the show notes as well. And John, it has been an honor. Thank you so much. This was a fabulous episode. We appreciate your time.
Hey, I love talking to you, Jim. Thank you.
Thank you.
Left Field Investors is a community dedicated to limited partner investors who are interested in building wealth through real estate investing. The community is focused on education, networking, and engagement with quality operators and partners. We provide tools, webinars, and a forum where members can discuss everything related to real estate investing, including deals, operators, investment strategies, and much more. Coming soon, we're adding a new tool, sponsor reviews. This will be a place where our members can rate and review operating partners to further help each other in our investment journeys. Check us out at leftfieldinvestors.com. Hello, left fielders. At LFI, you know our focus is on networking and education. Mark your calendars because we're going to have a full day of it dedicated to you, our limited partners, at the best ever conference on April 9th in Salt Lake City. LFI is opening the BEC with Passive Investing with Left Field Investors, an event focused on passive investors. This will be where insightful content meets passionate limited partners. If you enjoyed BEC last year and the meetup in Left Field this year, then imagine them both back to back. The Best Ever Conference isn't just any event. It's the premier conference for commercial real estate investors and operators. Your ticket to Passive Investing with Left Field Investors includes admission to the entire Best Ever Conference from April 9th through the 12th. Join us April 9th, where we will have a packed agenda with sessions focused on how to be a successful limited partner led by experienced LPs, top operators, and partners. Then, immerse yourself in the full Best Ever Conference, where you will be surrounded by like-minded investors, operators, and industry experts for unparalleled opportunities for learning and networking. The best part, and there are so many, but the best part, you won't find a bigger discount on the regular ticket price than the one you get for being an infielder. That's more content for an exclusive lower price. Register for the event today at leftfieldinvestors.com/BEC, and we will see you at Passive Investing with Left Field Investors at the BEC.
That was just great listening to John. Man, he has so much information. It makes it hard to do the end of episode review because all I want to do is just hit rewind and listen to that whole thing all over again because he had just so much good information. You know, he sees 2024 as kind of what he said is a reset and a staging year, which to me means that, you know, you really need to be getting your ducks in a row and really understanding where you want to invest moving forward because 2024 is going to set the stage for the next few years. And that's why it is so critical, as he said, to understand who the general partner is and really get to know the team because, you know, we talk about that, but do we really do it in depth enough where you're really understanding who's leading the project and who's leading the team so that you can have confidence in them moving forward? And this is it. This is the opportunity now to see who got through the tough times and who does, right? Over the next year or two, we're going to be seeing more and more operators who maybe didn't get through as cleanly as they should have or could have, and others that, you know, got through fine. And those are the ones that we're going to want to move forward with, are the ones that, you know, had this bump that everyone had, but got through it and in whatever way that they did that was satisfying to investors. So you want to also be looking for those who are outperforming now and you know, last year, this year, and maybe the next year, so that you can be ready to get to know them and invest with them, because someone who outperforms in the hard times might be someone you want to invest with when times get a little bit better. And then he went through a bunch of asset classes. And oh man, it was interesting that retail was the first one. He was pretty bullish on retail. And I find that interesting because retail has been, as he said, you know, with the e-commerce and everything, people were so down on it that it kind of surprised to the upside. And then he went through a whole bunch of other asset classes and just had some great points about each one. I won't summarize them here because, as I said, I'm going to go listen to this several times back and really just try to absorb everything that John was saying, because it was so impactful. And then we're talking about interest rates and normal. I put that in air quotes for those of you that are watching on YouTube. But what is normal? Well, it depends on how long you've been investing. If you were an investor in the 80s, you know, the interest rates today seem low. Whereas if you got your start, as John said, in the 2010s, you can't believe how high interest rates are right now. So normal really is relative. And we're not in an abnormal place with respect to interest rates. They might be going down a little bit, but as John said, they're not going down to, you know, 25 basis points or zero where they were for a while. We're now in the quote unquote normal range. And although it might go down a little bit, we need to figure out how to be good investors in the environment we're in. And we're going to be in this environment most likely for a while, plus or minus on the interest rate side. So again, this is the kind of episode that you know, I will listen to several times to get the full impact of everything John said. Just so grateful that John came on the show and gave us his time. It was really interesting to hear from him. And I'll be excited to connect with him at the Best Ever Conference. So if you're going out there in a couple of weeks, please be sure to look for Left Field Investors. We'll have a booth there, and also look for John and the Marcus Millichap crew. So that's all we have for this time. We'll catch you next time in the Left Field.
Thanks for hanging out in the Left Field with us today. If you are interested in becoming a left fielder, you can find us on the World Wide Web at www.leftfieldinvestor.com and click the subscribe button to join our community. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe to the show on your podcast player so you don't miss an episode. If you really enjoyed the show, a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts would be appreciated.
This show is for entertainment purposes only. Nothing said on the show should be considered financial advice. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by Passive Investing from Left Field and Left Field Investors. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.